Welcome to Spacers. This is an interview that was recorded before South by Southwest 2015. This is an interview with content strategist Margo Blumstein, and she's just a smart, positive person. Always enjoy talking to her. And of course, in this interview, we talk about content strategy, which is her specialty, but also that dress that went viral, if you remember that one, which no one seemed to guess which color it was correctly in the photo. Well, maybe you did. I totally botched my guess. So, some notes. If you haven't yet, there's still time to fly out and join me and wonderful speakers at CSS DevConf aboard the legendary Queen Mary in Long Beach, California, for 2 days of wonderful web development and web building techniques and tips and tricks. Check it out at cssdevconf.com. If you can't fly out and meet us at Long Beach, California, join us virtually wherever you have a great internet connection at SaaS Summit. Again, it's 2 days full of wonderful sessions, and each one is recorded. So if you work gets in the way, your friends in the way, family things get in the way, you can go back to recordings and view it as often as you want. So check it out, the sessions and everything at sassummit.com. And if you would, please be sure to go to iTunes, search for Non-Breaking Space Show in the podcast area, and subscribe to Non-Breaking Space, so that way you always get the latest show. And if you wouldn't mind, we are powered by stars, so if you could give us a 5-star rated review, that'd be great. That's it for now, and hope to see you next time. So this is your company is Appropriate Incorporated, is that right?
Yep, Appropriate Inc. Because I'm all about the double entendre.
And yeah, I think it's an awesome website. Looks great. And you've written the book Content Strategy at Work, the great book. How old is the book? As if you don't mind me asking, how
long it came out. Why? No, people should never ask a book's age. I'm horrified. Yeah. Oh, my sensibilities. Yeah. No, it came out March 2012. So, yeah, premiered at South by Southwest that year. So it's almost 3 years now.
Okay, that's cool. And see here, and then also on Twitter. You're M. Blumstein on Twitter.
Yes.
There you go. And yes. Then actually, you're actually talking about the dress. This is February 27th. And so last night, there was just the internet meltdown about the color of the dress, right? So
yes.
It was actually, from my understanding of the dress, the scenario of the problem with the dress is that it was backlighting a dress. That it's people asking what the color changes. So depending on what your view, your monitor resolution of it, I could be totally wrong about that, but that's just the way I understand it. Is that, it could look blue and black, or it could look gold and white. And so you're showing, Meyer has the science of why no one agrees on the color of this dress, and the fact that, color is relative anyway to begin with. It's, it goes into all this sciencey stuff like that. So it's color relative. So if you really want to break down the internet chaos that was yesterday evening, Wired has that article, The Science of Why No One Agrees on the Color of Dress. But I feel like what was really interesting was when people, I was reading the Facebook, and when Facebook would take the image and put it into Facebook, I think they would crop it and make an image of it or whatever. They would recalibrate the color palette somehow. And it would make it white and gold, but if you go back to the original photo, it was backlit, it was purple, stuff like that. So today we're just talking about dresses for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I loved how everyone was just sharing screenshots of their Photoshop color picker, just like, see, it's blue, and people fighting about it. I saw someone tweet that him and his wife hadn't fought in a while about something, and they were like, thanks, dress.
Well, I don't know, this morning, like, yeah, while the color controversy was yesterday and all, this morning watching so many brands clamor over each other to say something relevant right. about color and their brand and how people perceive it and all, that was just killing me. I mean, I think last night I saw, I think it was Hyundai, tweeted out something about the color of their cars. Yeah. And that was the brand that I saw respond to it.
Yeah.
And personally, my first thought was, okay, good. That's obviously a brand that has empowered their social media team to jump on things in a way that is on brand in the right editorial style and tone without having to monitor every tweet. So that's great. But then by the time this morning rolled around, and it was like you could see brands just sort of climbing over each other, just that was like halfway related.
Yeah.
And maybe relevant.
Right.
That was just like newsjacking is colorblind. Yeah. That was all I got out of it.
Right.
Yeah. It didn't matter if you were seeing blue or black or yellow or gold or just idiots through your Twitter stream. That's what I saw.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to try to jack the news, I guess, like you say, it's just as it's happening, but to come back like 12 hours later in the morning, like when your social media team, like it happened at night. So it was like, if your social media team was on, you know, was working at night, then you could, you know, work on top of it. But it sounds like everyone just rolled in the morning and was like, did you hear about this dress, you know, in the morning? So let's go talk about it. So for on social media, because we don't want to deal with real messages. So,
yeah, it's still the hashtag, like it's the top most hashtag except for Spock. Spock is the only thing above.
Right.
Dress.
I know. Leonard Nimoy. That's sad.
Yeah. So that's it. That's the other bit of news we have. So, pull up here. Is that he passed away today? I was in the science museum today, so I think that was when I heard the news. But a little bit apropos. But dies at 83. I don't. It's related to, from what I gather, he's confirmed his death, saying the cause was end-stage chronic obstructive pulmonary disease related to smoking that he stopped 30 years ago, but he says he didn't stop soon enough. So, in a tweet he made earlier. Mm. So yeah, really sad that he's gone. Also, kind of amazed because, excuse me, sorry. He retired from acting like two times. He retired from acting, but he somehow got him into two Star Trek movies before he passed away. So But yeah, he inspired a lot of people. A lot of, you know, he made Long Live and Prosper a thing that people know about. And I'm trying to wind my way to the fact that you definitely need to get his albums. His music albums and play them and enjoy them. So
yeah, he has like a number of spoken word albums, right?
Yeah.
Don't he and Shatner both have like a couple spoken word things?
Yeah. So iTunes, you can get the double header combo of the Shatner and Nimoy. So definitely, like, there's a song called "The Hobbit" that Nimoy has. It's really awesome. It's really great. The Alamo Theater is a it's really cool in Austin. They do, like, when The Hobbit was playing, they would do the music video of Nimoy singing The Hobbit. And so it was really awesome. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. But so definitely check it out. Also, you know, just Simpsons references, so just cultural icon, really. So then it inspired a lot of people going forward. So.
Yeah.
But
it was nice seeing him kind of like come back over the past few years too, in a number of like advertisements and commercials. Like there was one that he did with Zach Quinto, kind of both playing off the fact that they had played.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes. So the thing that really got that kind of pressed me yesterday was we had the rest of the llama situation, runaway llamas. Then we had the color dress issue, but then we also had I think what was really more important was like the FCC decided to take over the internet pretty much and regulate the internet a little bit. So SEC approves net neutrality rules for open internet. And so I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't know. This
I'm a little clueless. I stepped out. I was kind of out of it for most of it, so I'm not sure if you've, Margo, if you have an opinion on if it was good or bad or whatnot.
I was really excited to see the end result. I don't know if their ways of going about it, though, were entirely ideal, but I understand what they did. And I guess by that, I mean, by taking steps to regulate it, it falls in line with how the telephone industry has been kind of monitored and how it's changed since the 1930s. So they're definitely treating it as a utility and building on existing precedent. And I think that achieves the desired effect of making sure that everyone, regardless of their kind of financial stature and how they're perceived as a legal entity, will have equal access to it, right. And download speeds and all of those types of things. So I definitely agree with that effect. As far as how it's treated as a regulated or non-regulated utility, I don't know enough about that to know if the route that they took with it and those end goals or were the only way to do it, but I think it certainly makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Sam, do you have any opinion about that?
As far as what I've looked into it, it was good news because of not forcing people, like you said, with the economic decisions or economic implications that might have, or that people should have to pay not only for their Netflix. I think somebody used this example of like you're paying for your Netflix subscription, but then you pay your internet provider to then have faster speed so that you can then use Netflix. But it wouldn't be like for all of your sites. Somebody said it would be broken down by those individual services, and that just seemed like a lot of over-regulation. I don't think that no regulation should be the thing either, but just like finding the happy medium. But I think when it's been the way that it is, it's really hard to go in one direction or another.
Right.
But it also kind of freaked me out. The same article that you just pulled up on the screen was the one that I saw yesterday, and it was kind of weird seeing the hand-holding part of it. And also that something like that is a 3-2 vote. That just seems like a very, like, too close for my comfort level.
Well, look, a lot of freedoms that we take for granted today just came down to, like, one vote going one way or another, you know?
Yeah.
So it's that's kind of there's a pattern of that happening in this country, at least. So it's amazing how, like, just, I don't know, it's crazy how that happens. But, so I didn't know anything about it. Yes, go ahead, Margo.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know how that decision came down. I don't know that breakdown, the 3-2 ruling, is actually that surprising. I mean, I think it's definitely disappointing. Yeah. But when we look at how Republicans have been so dead against anything that even maybe opposes their own party credo and runs in opposition to how they've historically looked at individual rights versus corporate regulation, this ruling, it runs in the face of how the Republican Party has historically operated, like the pre-Reagan era Republican Party. But I think that it is completely in line with how it's operated during the Obama era, where if Obama's supporting something, most Republicans are going to fall in line and not support it, even if it goes against historically believed as a party, which I think is unfortunate. But this decision, I don't think, is surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like the Comcast example is that the idea is that Amazon could pay a ton of money for video streaming. And so they could advertise that they have faster video streaming while like Netflix would be locked out. And depending on your cable box, that was like one example. But then also the fact that the other problem is that with Europe, I saw like a clip of it yesterday. This is great. But how there's access to internet. That's great. It's over there, but it's not as fast as it is over here in terms of your mobile speed network telecoms. However, we still pay like a ton more money for that, and they don't have as much wire, fiber going into their office and some of that. But you know, the flip side is that Google is actually spending a ton of money and time trying to get Google Fiber set up at least eight cities now going up. And so that's as opposed to, you know, AT&T and other companies not, you know, just charging arm and leg for basic broadband. So I don't know. I'm not sure how it breaks down. So anyway, so that gives me to, I asked Simon St. Laurent, who actually works at O'Reilly, who's actually smarter than I am, what he thought of it. And so he actually recommends this book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. And so it's based off of AT&T, the story of AT&T and the monopolies and what kind of history, like the history, like we're talking about in the 1930s and stuff like that too. So I got it downloaded and I'm ready to read it. But he says it's a good book and good book to see how what it is, you know, like a good way to put in a good frame. So I actually just got it today. So I'm going to check it out. Probably talk about it later on. Probably get Simon on the show later on and talk about it. Just because I feel like with the with our Congress, our politicians have mastered the art of naming things that on bills that you don't want to hear, you know, that are really bad for you. So like, this bill sounds really awesome, and then he actually passes it, and like, oh wait, all right, cool. And then that's about it. And internet news this week is one time besides llamas. Margo, so glad you're here. I just want to see, just going to start off, focus on you for the next you know, portion of the show. The question that we always ask people is, how do you get into the web? Like, what was your first exposure to the web, and what made you decide to have a career on the web?
Have you guys seen the movie Snowpiercer? I know we were just talking about Netflix and what now. It's not the best movie, but it is compelling and whatnot. There's some big plot issues. One of the lines in it, one of the characters turns to another one and calls her a train baby because everyone is on this train. They've been on it 17 years. She's never known a life before being on this train. And I kind of think life on the internet, because when I graduated college, it was height of the dot-com era. Like most of my friends were going to work in the internet economy, and I was certainly no different. Internship in a design agency probably around 93-94, when I was still in high school, and that was more focused on print design and solving problems through typography and and layout and whatnot, and really kind of traditional aspects of print design. And then by the time I graduated college, I studied communication design at Carnegie Mellon and then moved into content strategy. And my first job out of school was at Sapient. I know you guys interviewed Karen McGrane recently, and she talked about coming out of her master's program and going directly to Razorfish and the time those years to go to. And the team that I joined there at Sapient in their Cambridge office was their creative services team within the content strategy team within their creative services team. And so when people say content strategy is new, I always kind of look at them kind of strange, because I feel like, no, I've been working in it for about 15 years now. And at the time, the team was called Content Strategy. I feel like it was half copywriting and other parts really about structured content, even though we didn't always call it that, but it was still about imposing consistency and editorial style and tone. But at times without the platform to maintain and run. So now when we talk about structured content, it's certainly come a long way.
Oh, what made you switch from the design side? And I hate to use the word switch as if it's like two completely different unrelated things, but what kind of made you move away from the design focus to the content side?
Well, at the time, I mean, I think that really a lot of the questions that I was starting to ask, both within the communication design program and then as I was interviewing with different agencies, a lot of the questions that I was asking for how they would interact with their clients and how they would solve their client problems were really content questions and workflow questions. And I didn't know that that was content strategy, but eventually, and it was actually through the process of interviewing, I met with some folks on the design and information architecture teams at Sapient, and they asked how I would solve a problem. And I started proposing different ideas, and they were like, that's great, but you need to talk with the folks in content strategy about that. Because I think I started talking about like target audiences and communication goals and some of like their choices around verbal style and that sort of thing and the chunks of content that they would be working with. And then in my next interview, I met with their head of content strategy and she took a great, wonderful chance on me. That was Kristen Connor, and she still works in content strategy and creative direction. And she was a wonderful mentor to me. A lot of folks on the team there were just tremendous, tremendous mentors. And then I quickly learned that a lot of the skills that I had developed in design around visual problem solving, I was still engaged in problem solving, but rather than approaching those issues through typography choices and decisions around color and the density of information on the page. Instead, I was sort of pulling other levers around style and tone, diction, content types, all of those types of things.
Cool. Yeah, well, I want to talk about that. Like the when you pull other levers, as a content strategist, like you know, tone, like what problems, like you know, can you just explore that more? Like what type of techniques do you use and what type of problems do they solve? Because I just find that just so fascinating.
Sure. I think clients or when organizations first reach out to me, it's because something that they're doing isn't achieving. Maybe they for a long time and they're trying to reach another audience and feel like their messaging is just falling on deaf ears and not getting anywhere. Or maybe they feel like, you know, they get into Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest. In other cases, it's because they say, you know, our parts of our brand, maybe our existing print collateral, but we just keep pouring the same money in and we've always done the same things.
Right.
And we don't know if we should be shifting in other ways. I'm working with a higher ed institution right now that's going through that kind of challenge. They've always produced a view book. They've always produced a big course catalog. Now, a lot of those things are online and all, but there's still parts of their faculty that very much focus on those types of tools and have always focused on those sort of vehicles and channels to reach their target audience. Now they're starting to say, well, what if our target audience is shifting? What if the people that have always historically come to us, the students that have always come to us for our strength in very traditional subjects, what if they're interested in maybe more more innovative avenues of education now? What if they want to be exploring things from really radical angles? Are we still projecting those sort of strengths? And they may know, and their faculty may know, but if that doesn't come out in their messaging in a consistent, clear and accurate way, then their audience isn't going to know that. And if their audience doesn't know it, they may look to another institution and say, that school's great, but it's not for me. And if they don't want to lose those students before they've even had a chance to convince them that, yes, this is the place for you, they need to look at their content. So some of the techniques and whatnot that I'm using to work with them on, that all starts with first developing their message architecture and helping them figure out what their communication goals are. And if it's more important to look innovative or entrepreneurial, maybe more so than looking traditional and established and all those other things that a lot of schools typically embrace, but maybe aren't always right for their students and their prospective students.
So is communication goal the same as how you want to be perceived, or like, you know, you talk about do we come across as innovative, or is there like something more finite or more quantifiable than that?
I guess when I talk about an organization's communication goals, I'm looking at at the brand attributes that they want their target audience to feel for them, kind of in their hearts and minds, that they want to have associated with them. I think for a lot of brands that don't have that clear sort of sense of self, that don't have clear communication goals and a clear hierarchy of those messages, if you were to strip away their logo and maybe their color scheme from mm-hmm. their website and print collateral and Twitter stream and all those things, if you were to do that, I don't know that you could look at their content and still identify who they were. Right. I think because in many industries, a lot of brands, once you take away their logos, mm-hmm. they kind of look and sound the same. And it's because they don't have clear communication goals. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are definitely great exceptions to that. Like, for example, we can look at the airline industry and see how brands like JetBlue versus Virgin versus kind of the old standbys of like US Air and United mm-hmm. and whatnot. We can see how they focus on communicating their brands in very, very different ways through okay. the choice of channels in which they're very active, as well as through things like editorial style and tone. And that's great. It's great that you can take away JetBlue's logo and take away yeah. the logo of Southwest. And then if you look at, say, their Twitter streams, mm-hmm. you can tell who's who because they sound mm-hmm. very, very different. That's a powerful thing.
How do you, talking about goals for a second, does it happen frequently? I know it happens with design a lot. Does it happen in content a lot where their goals aren't necessarily what the goals should be? So I think of Marty Neumeier's, he's a brand strategist and a writer. And in one of his books, I think it's When They Zig Zag. And he says, it just slipped my mind. It's not what you think you are, it's what they think it is, I think, paraphrasing, and kind of that the reputation is the brand, not what you think you're putting out there. So from the content side, is that something that you have to pull clients in a lot and be like, well, you think you might be doing this, but this is actually what's happening?
Yes and no. I think there's a lot of branding that is that's aspirational, and it should be, because typically when an organization reaches out for help on content strategy or help on design or all of the above, it's because they want to communicate something different. So it shouldn't mm-hmm. be about just what they are now or how they've mm-hmm. always been. Instead, it needs to be more about, well, where do you want to go? Let's skate mm-hmm. to where the puck is going and get you there as well. So I think there's that opportunity to say, well, regardless of how it's always been, who do you want to be when you grow up? And of course, we have to kind of lay that groundwork and say, all right, this is how people currently perceive you. Mm-hmm. How are we going to shift their perception? And what can you start doing on a repeatable, regular basis so that they'll believe that as well? So I think there is that element to it. But yeah, I mean, what Marty writes is definitely true too, in that we can only, as professional communicators, we can only do and shape and influence so much. Mm-hmm. I think when a brand is kind of contributing to a shared space with their audience, that sort of rhetorical arena between the target audience and the speaker, mm-hmm. the audience is bringing just as much into that space as we are. And they're bringing baggage and past experiences and existing perceptions to the table too. So yeah, we can't control it, but we can certainly influence things. And I think that's where the opportunity is.
So have you ever had to tell a client, if they hire you as a consultant, they'd be more open and willing, but sometimes that's not the case, where they hire you and they have a definite endpoint in mind. But sometimes if they hire you, are they open to say, like, this is kind of like a self-assessment, like, this is not where you actually are, you're actually way different than where your content is, and let's get it to where you're actually going? Is that, you ever had those discussions with clients where like you really have it you don't understand what you're outputting out there is actually not what you're actually saying? Or
I would say most of the sort of reality checks that I have with them are brand perception, and usually more around quality of content. And I guess that's because maybe we're not focusing so much on brand perception perception, so much brand, a nice sort of fantastical place. It's kind of like that Henry David Thoreau comment that it's great that you've built castles in the air. That's where they should be. Strategy is about castles in the air, that they want to be perceived in a certain way, and they have lofty goals. Mm-hmm. Now we need to make sure that it's realistic to achieve. I feel like a lot of the sort of reality check conversation I have with them are around and go one of two ways. Usually they'll come in and they'll say, all of our content is horrible. Mm-hmm. Or, they're so wildly off. Because usually what happens is as we get into the process and maybe go through a content audit that's both qualitative and quantitative, then we can start asking, is your content any good? And okay, what makes it good? How do we define good?
Right.
And that's usually a very telling question, because I think for some organizations, when they say, oh, all of our content is terrific,
right,
it's engaging,
yeah,
whatever that means. Maybe it got a certain number of clicks. Okay, did those clicks translate into sales or whatever they're in business to be doing? Or in other cases, when they say it's good, it's because it's up to date and doesn't have any typos in it, which should be a really, really low bar. That should be kind of table stakes for any kind of organization that's trying to speak with others. But we know that it's not always the case. So I think a lot of times when we're having those discussions of what's aspirational and what's real, mm-hmm, it's usually around the quality of the content itself rather than kind of where they want things to go. I think that for many organizations, their goals around where they'd really love to go, those things, they might be lofty, but they're usually not unattainable.
Yeah, so, you know, So definitely you go in there. It's like, if I say like our content is terrible because we're not getting enough links or click-throughs, what would you say would be my, yeah, where would you start from there? Like what would be the major problem that I would have? Like, how would you address that issue? Or like, where'd you start with?
I think I would start by asking why. Why do you want more links or click-throughs?
Mm-hmm. Just because it makes me feel great.
Like, what's the value of that? What's that?
It just makes me feel awesome to have more clicks. That's all. Yeah, well, I want to have clicks to...
That's good.
Yeah, I feel great when people come to my site. That's awesome. But no, let's say like I need clicks to get conversions, you know, and more people seeing the content means more ad exposures, more, you know, videos and some of that, more videos and some of that. So, yeah.
I guess I don't know what that means. Like, why do you want to have more of those? And if you're an organization that's in business to sell a certain number of products or to have more loyal customers, so more sales to existing customers, or if you're in business to try to, maybe you're running a conference or something and you're trying to attract more attention that results in more registration for that conference.
Right.
I think we always have to ask, okay, just because clicks or link backs or something like that are sort of like this hot currency right now, we have to ask, what does it translate to? Does it actually help you reach your goal? Selling more stuff or attracting more customers or registering more more clients. And I think there's a fundamental gap in a lot of organizations between the metrics of social media
and
full metrics of hard sales. And we can't forget that latter component, because if what we're doing doesn't at the end of the day on visibility and popularity and engagement. Right. Like, those are all lovely things. Who doesn't want to be popular?
Right.
But what does it actually get you? I mean, I'm not a fan of Cuba Gooding Jr. I think he's a bad actor, but I think this is kind of the show me the money moment in content marketing and in social media.
All right. So I think the news bomb is that the Oscar-winning actor, Cuba Gooding Jr.,
I can't believe I just quoted him too.
All right, so
you know, he was in that movie Snow Dogs. I don't know if you guys saw that. I think it was called Snow Dogs, and I was so excited about that because I saw these billboards and these ads that had talking dogs in them, and I'm a huge dog person, and I was like, talking dogs, this is best thing ever committed to film. And then I was like, why do they have to ruin it for me with him? I think not a fan.
Not a fan. Okay.
Well, then he's never going to listen to the show. No, I'm kidding. I doubt he's listening to the show.
The No Cuba Gooding Club. That's what we have. Yeah. That's our tagline. Yeah.
Give me more talking dogs, please.
Give them. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So let's just say, I'm just going to give you a hypothetical. I am a social media site, but I update daily as much as I can about pop culture events like llamas, the color of dresses, and so forth and so much on the topics of the day. So my content varies, but I'm also want to sell T-shirts at the same time. So I want to. I'm not sure what my what would you, is that like a sandpit of a terrible idea that needs content strategy, or would that just where would you start from that, I guess?
Is this an existing site or new business venture that you're contemplating?
It's an existing site, I'm out there just publishing, every time there's a Facebook trend, I'll just do a clip, a quick 100 word posts out there and just push it out there.
And smack that meme on a T-shirt and get it out there before any of your competitors, that type of thing.
Yeah, maybe like I have a really cool T-shirt idea and I just want to put it out there. But the translation is that, per million click-throughs, I'll sell T-shirts or something like that. I want to rip my thing up. I mean, is that really a bad example for you, or is that just not got really good?
Because I guess what's the problem that you'd want to solve with that?
I really want to change my business model, probably, is my problem. So I guess what I really want to know is just what type of techniques you use to help clients and just specific. And I know there's certain tools for certain answers. And so I want to not be too vague about it, but I feel like I totally went there into that vague area with my solution. But I just like if you could just give an overview of some of the techniques that you use, like when talking to the clients and doing content stuff. Because I know Karen McGreen talks about chunking content, and so she talks about definitely having a small like a one line bit of content for TV episodes, usually the TV guide episode of. One sentence summary for episodes, a three sentence summary for episode, and a whole paragraph for episodes or TVs. And so the TV guide now can broadcast different episode summaries depending on the medium and chunking of content that way. So, so if what type of techniques do you use when talking to clients and what techniques work in situations that are great and which are not?
So in general, I guess when I start to work with a client and like to use your example of the social media site that's pulling in a lot of news and generating T-shirts and whatnot as well, I guess I'd want to know what the business model and the business vision there are, kind of holding that all together there. I typically start out by asking them like what is their vision for the business, like looking out to 3, 4, 5 years. Is it that they're going for some kind of like short-term customer acquisition and then looking to be looking to sell or something? Mm-hmm. Are they going to like in search of expanding their target audience, maybe shifting their target audience, or even like shifting the main thing for which they're known, for which their brand is known. Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of organizations are in that position that maybe they've made their name in a certain space and then are looking to make a lateral move. Maybe they've begun kind of by focusing on military contracts, and they're eager to move into a more consumer-friendly space, maybe by repurposing existing technology. Mm-hmm. I think when we have those kinds of challenges in front of us, it's important to kind of get on the table, like, all right, so where do we need to go over the length span, over the time that whatever particular channel we're targeting might be serving you. And I find in general, when we look at something along like 2 years or so, we're able to say, all right, so where should we start making those investments? What content can we shift or repurpose or maybe have our eyes on for using in a different way? Mm. From there, that's where I'll typically start by saying, all right, so let's look more at your communication goals. Yeah. And help them put together a message architecture. And there's a few different ways that we can get at that. But I find that without that, without understanding their hierarchy of communication goals, it's really tough to measure if their existing content is helping them or hurting them, if it is any good for however they're defining good. And without knowing the value of their existing content, it's tough to say, well, what should they be doing differently? Right. I liken it a lot to sort of a metaphor of like, if you open up your refrigerator and you're like, I don't know what I should be making for dinner tonight. But you see a lot of random ingredients. You don't know if they're any good. I mean, you can look at their expiration dates and maybe that's one way to say, are these good? But you don't know if they're relevant for whatever sort of meal you have in mind. Or maybe if you're having friends over, do you know if they're vegan? Do you know if they're vegetarian? Are they keeping kosher? What sort of rules do you need to apply to this? What are your goals for the meal? I think the same applies to when we're looking at content. Like content can be perfectly current, but it may not be relevant anymore. Or it might be really great, factually accurate, but entirely the wrong content types for a channel that you're targeting. Maybe you've always published things in the form of white papers, and they're great, and they really establish your brand as being very studious and erudite and respected. But maybe you're trying to shift to be seen as being more hip and fun and engaging, and those white papers just aren't going to fly when your target audience or the audience you'd like to have is on Facebook. So there's those kind of challenges that we can face. Yeah, it's tough to get people to love those PDFs.
Right. So, and I love the fridge metaphor because any food metaphor, I grok instantly. So that's so cool. So I can see, like, as a content strategist, or like as what you do, you in order to help people, you need to know where they want to go, like the whole castles in the sky thing. You want to, like, in order for me to know if the ingredients or the content that you have in your fridge right now are worthwhile, I need to know where you want to go 2 to 5 years from now, or, you know, what you want to go. And then I could say, like, okay, then you can ascertain what content that you have is now is relevant. And so your goal is like, hey, do you want to be bought? Do you want to shift brands? Do you want to shift to open up to more markets? Or more industries that you want to do that. So if you were to know, so you use that as a marker, it's like where you want to go as the marker, and then you use that as a judge of how well the content a client has is right now. Is that good?
Right. And I think without knowing an organization's goals, without fully understanding its message architecture, you can't possibly know if the content they have is any good. And you can't possibly understand, well, what content do they need to have? And if that's something that you can achieve by repurposing existing content, repackaging it for different channels, or if it's something that they need to create from scratch. And then I would say we can also go a step further to say when organizations are looking to hire into a content team, hire into their marketing team, unless they know the kinds of content they need to be creating. So unless they've already figured out their communication goals, it's really tough to understand, well, what sort of skill set should you be hiring for? Do you need a crack content strategist? Do you need a really wonderful copywriter or a ghostwriter? Or maybe instead you need somebody that's more skilled at videography or in creating custom photography for the brand. Or maybe you should be taking that budget instead and just socking it into stock photography. Right. I mean, I think those are all options that can help you achieve similar goals. Okay. But unless you understand what you're trying to communicate, it can be really difficult to allocate those resources appropriately.
Right. Well, I mean, like, so content strategist is also like a content creator, because like when you talk about seeking money into stock photos or like making videos, from that, I think of those as content creation. Is that also a content strategist job as well?
I think it depends on the company and on the content strategist. Okay. I'd say when we say that it's the process of planning for the creation and aggregation, governance and expiration of content that is useful, usable, and appropriate to a brand, that all talks about planning for those things. So looking at the process, the workflow, are the right people in place? But the actual act of executing on content strategy, which might be copywriting, it might be photography, it might be working as an art director, that falls more into content marketing. Or I should say that's execution that can at times spin off into content marketing. Okay. Content marketing is one way of executing on a content strategy, but then there's other types of content that need to be created beyond just marketing or beyond just content designed to influence sales. We can look at other content types such as instructional copy and error messaging, nomenclature. Those are all aspects of content that someone has to think about as well and to go through the appropriate process in order to do so. So I would say the lines blur a little bit in there, but then when you talk to specific content strategists or individual content strategists, some of us do focus on the execution side as well. So there, I think it comes down to more who's in the role, what's their skill set, what are their particular preferences.
Yeah, definitely. So it's about execution versus, you know, I guess it would depend on the scenario that you have. So let's say you have a company that wants to, I feel like it's a little too big maybe to be bought in 2 years, but maybe shifting brands would probably be a bigger way. Like they want to shift to a more hipper brand or more self awareness in the industry that they want to do. So and take the brand to a different level. And so that would mean you talked about earlier about how you might have to shift the tone of the content and to be more hipper approach. You know, like say they have really solid Class A white papers. So that's a very like, you know, they definitely, you know, take that content out of PDF and mold that. So would that just go down to thinking about how to take that content or generate new content? New strategies and then allocate like a budget and see who executes that. Is that a typical content strategist scenario or not? So I just, I'm coming from
yeah,
this, like,
I think,
I'm kind of like this from a total, like, just so you know, like I'm a design background, do a little bit, you know, programming here or there, but so I'm more of a generalist, so I don't really specialize in a lot of things. So like, I'm really trying to like ask you, just to see if this helps you with your answer, just like what are the tools that you use to like really get into the nitty gritty and pick apart things so like you actually have like a very comprehensive content strategy to it. So if that helps.
In the example that you gave, if an organization's maybe got this wealth of white papers and they're saying, but we need to make this more accessible maybe to a younger, hipper audience or to reposition our brand to seem a bit hipper and more in touch. Yeah. I think I would start probably by taking a look at those white papers. Just because they have a lot of them doesn't mean that they're any good. So again, how do we define good? So is the content in those white papers, is it current? Is it still relevant for the big themes that they want to address in their industry? And also, is the tone right for their messaging? In many industries that oftentimes create position papers, we see issues around lots and lots of passive voice lots and lots of long nominalizations and long sentences, which can be great for establishing a brand as very immovable and established and traditional, but may not play well beyond that. So we may need to kind of translate those things first just to get them into the right style and tone. And then from there, we can start looking at, well, what are the big themes in the existing content? Can we extract certain points, maybe certain bits of their thought leadership and spin them out into a series of tweets instead? Mm-hmm. Is it maybe good information that would play really well in a podcast if we got the original writer or somebody that's equally a good subject matter expert to instead talk about the same concepts, but in this kind of more oral presentation that should instead become a keynote presentation that they can take on the road and through a lot of different conferences and other events? Should we be spinning out that same information that way?
Okay.
There's that continuum that you're probably familiar with of data, information, knowledge, and wisdom. And I think when we look at content that's already kind of locked up in existing content types, like a white paper. Right. What we're looking at is a lot of data and a lot of information. Mm-hmm. But that knowledge level, that's sort of locked within the content type. We can take that same information and spin it out in different ways to create new knowledge from it, depending on the channel which we're sharing it. So I think there's always that kind of opportunity. And oftentimes both the style and tone and format of content in those channels, yeah, as well as the choice of channel itself, those decisions contribute to then how the brand is perceived. In other words, if you say something in a shorter sentence with really strong active verbs leading the way, and you say it on Twitter, even though there might be the same information in those 140 characters as you had in a full-on paragraph in that white paper, because the tone is different and the choice of channel is different, the perception that goes back to the brand then can change as well.
Right.
So I think there's those kinds of opportunities. And as far as the tools to get there, a lot of it comes down to a lot of time-consuming, unsexy stuff of taking existing content and weeding through it and bringing it into a spreadsheet and cataloging all of the different bits within it. And that's a lot of what goes on in structured content, probably a lot of what Karen talks about as well, in going from kind of blobs to chunks, going from like big content sets and breaking it down into its constituent parts so that we can then tag it and reuse it appropriately. There's that step before reuse of translating it as well, making sure that it's in the right style and tone for the medium.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Or for the channel. So but I think that's all kind of a part of wrestling with structured content.
Right. So is that like content analysis, like in terms of like you just go through all your mediums and stuff, all the content that's out there, and you kind of like catalog it as to where it is and what it says, and then how long it is? Is that sort of like a typical content analysis, per se, like all the meta information that goes along with that?
That's part of the content auditing process. When I said before, it's both a qualitative and quantitative process. Mm-hmm. Typically, when we're going through a content audit, we're saying, well, what do we have? And where does it live? If it's copy, how many characters is it? What are they associated? If it's an image, how big is it? Maybe what is it content? Adding that as well, kind of more fully informing it. Also, how does it relate to similar content around it? One of the examples that I tend to look at a lot, just because you see this in both higher ed websites as well as agency and consulting websites, are the issues of staff bio. Because it's a content type that everybody kind of gets. Like usually if you go to like the About Us section on a website, headshots, some higher ed institutions, you can click over to say like a department's About Us section or the list of faculty, and the variety that you see in there can be astounding. Maybe some people have never bothered to get a current headshot. Maybe some faculty members have really, really long bios, and in other cases, they're really short.
Yeah.
And that's very revealing, because the perception that it sends is first one of inconsistency. Right. And also it may send the message that people with really long bios are far more important than people that only have very short biographies.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's the complete opposite case. It's just the people with really short bios are so busy and so entrenched in their industries, they haven't had time to fill out the silly form or to add that into the CMS.
Right. Okay.
So we can learn a lot from that. And that all comes through then in the content audit. Yeah. I mean, and I think there are a pretty simple content type that everybody understands, but they reveal a lot about the organizations that publish them.
Right.
How early are the content audits in the process? Is that really close to kickoff? Is that right after maybe an initial interview where you are figuring out what the business model is and the goal is? I'm kind of curious just where in the timeline of working or consulting on content does the content audit happen?
That usually happens pretty early on. And I would say it's never too early to start thinking about your content and start thinking about your content types, even if you don't yet start thinking about copy or specific imagery. And I know for a long time when we were kind of having that debate of mobile first or content first, there was a lot of wrangling around that. And I think for most people, we were kind of arguing for the same thing. Like, let's think about what our communication goals are first. I actually wrote a piece about a year ago that appeared in Print Magazine that talked about communication goals first, why we need to lay that foundation in order to make better design decisions and better content and copy and imagery decisions and channel decisions later on. So early on in the project, we can start discussing those communication goals, establish the message architecture, and then as soon as we've reached that point, then we can conduct that content audit to better inform information architecture, resources around design, resources around content creation. The thing is, if the content audit reveals that, yes, all of your content is current, but the tone is wildly off, or that it's really all very poorly written, that clues us in a lot about the budget moving forward, the sort of resources we need moving forward. I mean, maybe it turns out that all of your copy is terrific. That never happens, but maybe that happens. Maybe it turns out all of the copy is terrific, so really we should be allocating more budget around photography and that sort of thing.
So how, when it does come to this sort of audit scenario, are other players a part of that process, or is that something kind of that content people need to figure out first? And I mean other players like designers or perhaps developers, people that may have to touch that content, an editor of a podcast or that audio, whoever the copywriter is, are they a part of the auditing process as well?
And also, I want to piggyback off of that one, if you don't mind, just like as a content strategist and doing content, like for brand also, like, do you have to look at a brand like the designer has a logo or new logo or new thing? Do you work in tandem with the creation of a new brand, or do you content, or would a company sometimes hire you after they come up with a new brand and say, our new content needs to be hip and bold, like this new logo or something like that? So.
I hate the answer that it depends, but I guess it depends on the project as well as on the content strategist. Yeah, I know for me, because my background is in design, on many projects, I'll oftentimes work, at the very least, I'll work closely with the designers. Mm-hmm. On some projects, depending on the other individuals on the team, I'll play more the role of creative director / content strategist, especially if there's more junior designers on the team, because I like mentoring as well. Typically, we'll start out with that message architecture, and those communication goals should really be fueling both design and content choices, because we want the experience to be consistent and cohesive visually and verbally. I think we've all opened up magazines or seen print collateral that maybe looks one way and sounds completely different, and it creates this really kind of weird dissonant experience for the user. I don't even know if you can call it a cohesive user experience at that point. It's just sort of jarring. So I'll typically work really closely with the design team, and I think especially as we're establishing those communication goals and then seeing how we want to run with them, kind of moving beyond the content audit, that has to be a very collaborative process. And then moving forward, as we're figuring out, well, what are the right content types? What should they say? As well as how should they look? We need to be going back and forth and having those conversations a lot of not just what's the right style and tone, but also what's the right typeface in which to engage the audience. So there's constantly that kind of collaboration and give and take. And I think, Christopher, to answer your question about like how content and design influence each other, I think like for the example of like relaunching a brand, let's say, because a brand is so much more than a logo, but we also have to think about, well, what does it need to communicate?
Yeah.
We have to be thinking, well, should the language feel really abrupt and choppy, smooth and mellifluous? And then what's the right kind of color scheme? What's the right sort of texture and graphic language to communicate all of those same qualities? It isn't going to work if those ideas and concepts aren't coming from the same place. And that place is the message architecture.
And I love the phrase, I love the term message architecture. And so is message architecture all the placement of the brand and design and the voice and the tone all coming together? Is that the message architecture?
Well, the message architecture is just the hierarchy of communication goals. What do they want to communicate? And is it more important to sound or accessible or approachable or very elite. And then from there, that gives us sort of the audit and to establish and more decisions about governance as far as who should be updating things and at what frequency and what are the big themes on which they should be hitting. Mm-hmm. The themes in the editorial calendar, we should be able to trace all the way back to the message architecture. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just a matter of just simply jumping at whatever llama drama is in the news today.
Llama drama. So governance is the issue, right? So is that like a sticky widget? Like you have to deal with stakeholders and like who has control of the content creation, right? So who gets final say? Is that a part of review for the content strategist?
Yeah, I feel like governance is one of those areas where content strategy confronts its greatest element of reality, that we're not simply recommending, oh, you should do this and start publishing a blog, but we also have to say, well, how and who's going to be doing that? And what's the editorial workflow for them? Will the same person be creating blog posts as we'll also be reviewing them and approving them? Is the CMO writing everything? And if so, really, how are they in charge of other aspects of marketing then? So I think governance is kind of where we prove the validity and the value of content strategy. And it can also be the more challenging part of any project. I think when we have, or when you hear of content strategy initiatives that only address maybe a content management system, when they're kind of all caught up in the hardware and the software, they miss that the place where most content lives and dies is with the wetware. It's with the people that we're asking to perform all of this. So, I think getting back to kind of the issue of collaboration on most projects, I usually work really closely with my clients to find out, well, what's feasible for content. They may want to have a blog. They may love the idea of blogging, but realize that nobody on the team is that great a writer. And the only person that actually has time to be doing this is the marketing intern that's going to be going away at the end of the summer anyhow. So those are issues that we have to contend with before making any kind of recommendations if we want them to be sustainable. And that process is also the act of kind of getting close to the client and saying, what's realistic? Just because you're available to do something or someone on your team is, availability is not a skill set.
Right.
Do we need to hire different people or train in different ways so that this is sustainable? And those are all the kind of questions that have to feed in then to a governance plan and to an editorial calendar and editorial style guidelines.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and then who's going to be in charge of, writing the color dress, tweets,
exactly.
Yeah, when you have to fly by a seat of your pants, who's gonna be the guy? Who's on call to answer the dress color issue and the llama issues? So governance is always an issue. But how many times do you walk into? It's really important. Recently, I was kind of reading around like the importance of a company where like everyone actively blogs. Is that have you noticed that lately in clients where like people are just they're asking a lot more of their employees to blog more?
I am seeing more and more organizations that have gotten past the idea that social media is just the purview of a social media department or just the responsibility of the marketing department. So I am seeing more organizations that realize that they can't really control that, so it would be better if they can support how all of their employees are using social media and possibly give them more responsibility to engage, like through their blog, that type of thing. Okay. But at the same time, I feel like I'm also seeing more organizations that are saying, yeah, we're going to have everybody blogging,
right.
But then they're not focusing on, well, what's the workflow that needs to support that? Are we incentivizing people to blog or just asking them to? Right. And are we creating the time and space and the tools in their workflow then to be able to support that kind of creativity? I think blogging, like any kind of content creation, has an opportunity cost. If people are focusing on that kind of content creation, it means they're not putting their creativity elsewhere. And that may be perfectly fine, mm-hmm. as long as we're realistic about the time that people have in their day and what else we're asking them to do and that sort of thing.
Do you think that with it, that sort of scenario that Chris just brought up, is there, and I bet this is going to be one of those it depends answers, or probably. When there is more of that content coming in from those different voices, does that basically come back to, well, is the goal that all the voices are heard, or is it more about kind of having a unique tone that is cohesive at the end? Or does it just come down to what the goals are?
I was just about to say, well, it depends. But I think the challenge in many organizations is realizing that a company is not a monolithic entity. A company comprises mm-hmm. people. And mm-hmm. those people do all have unique voices. We can't mandate that they all sound the same. And frankly, you wouldn't want them to. Mm-hmm. I think in most cases where you've got multiple bylines in a blog or in any kind of publication, you've done that. You've gone through the process of aggregating people with different strengths and hiring a diverse talent pool because you want to have those diverse perspectives. You want to have many voices at the table rather than just kind of a bunch of robots that are able to repeat the same thing over and over. But that's also, I think that's a relatively new way of thinking about corporations and brands and how they engage with their audiences. I mean, if we look kind of back in industry, and certainly at a lot of more traditional organizations and corporations over the past 50 years, the role of industry was to be able to get really efficient at cranking out the same thing over and over and over. And because of that, we had assembly lines, and then people were more and more replaced with robots and more efficient. And they didn't require breaks. And that's great for produce the same thing over and over and over. But I think when we look at more modern organizations, when they're not looking to simply replicate the same product again and again, but create equally positive but very tailored experiences for their users and for their consumers. We don't want to just have the same voice constantly coming out of that organization, especially if we've got a lot of different people on the corporate blog. So I think as organizations kind of approach that realization and maybe move through that maturity model, they realize the value in having a lot of different voices that can maybe reiterate and underscore and support the same points, but by putting their unique spin on it.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That is a really interesting thing to see, that there are that the curation of those voices, the different voices, is becoming a part of a lot of the brand now, that it doesn't have to be like, we are this one thing, we are this one goal, and we're actually a collection of things. So yeah. I think that's an interesting model to see.
And I think it's humanizing too when mm-hmm. brands acknowledge that it isn't one person that's on the same Twitter account 24/7, but rather mm-hmm. that Twitter account comprises many humans that mm-hmm. have right. shifts and take breaks and whatnot.
Right. Yeah. It's also.
And I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say. I mean, unless, because I don't know if it is always abundantly clear, but because people have relationships with people more so than with brands, it's great when brands can kind of bolster up and increase the visibility of the humans that they comprise.
A little bit, but so do you have any, where would be a good place to go from here if I want to learn more about brand and content strategy and some of that? So where would you, any books, any blogs, any articles?
Sure. Well, there's a number of excellent conferences that are going to be coming up over the next few months that are either all about content strategy or in which content strategy is featured heavily, which I'm really excited about. There's the Intelligent Content Conference is coming up in late March after South by Southwest. I'm going to be appearing at South by Southwest this year, and I'm really excited because this year I'm not doing a talk, but I'm going to be there formally as a mentor. I'm really excited about that. So if folks are going to be in Austin and want to schedule a time to talk, I think I've got like an hour block in the schedule, and you can grab a chunk of that.
Cool.
So good opportunities to talk breaking into content strategy, freelancing, dogs talking in cinema, all of those things are good. Awesome. And then also following Intelligent Content Conference coming up in April, I believe, there's the Now What Conference in Sioux Falls. Mm-hmm. The Confab Events main conference in Minneapolis is coming up. Also, they just recently released the schedule and list of speakers for Confab Intensive out in Portland, which is going to be a great time because it's all workshops, and I'm going to be leading a workshop there specifically around establishing a message architecture. So that'll be a good time too. And then early on in the podcast, we talked a little bit about Carnegie Mellon, and I'm excited because I'm going to be back in Pittsburgh in June speaking at Web Design Day, and content strategy is going to be featured pretty heavily there as well. Then I think for folks that aren't, yeah, there's a wealth that they can be reading certainly on the different blogs coming out of those conferences, as well as the Brain Traffic blog, my own blog at appropriateinc.com. And then A List Apart has been featuring a lot on content strategy lately. I know Eileen Webb just had a wonderful article there. Yeah, Lisa Marie great. Martin's been writing a lot for it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So lots and lots and lots of good resources out there.
Right. And I'm going to throw in that content strategy summit's going to happen again this year too. So people don't want to travel.
Excellent. Yes. Yeah.
But cool.
Yeah. Awesome. So see, you don't even have to travel to go to a conference because there's virtual events you can take advantage of too.
Yes. Pants are optional if you want to. But PJs are a must. But
yes. Yes.
Awesome. I think this is great. Thank you so much for being with us today, Marva. Do you have any questions for us at all?
I'm curious to hear more about what you're seeing kind of as you interact with other speakers and with other parts of the industry. What do you see as the big challenges that content strategy needs to be confronting more head on?
It's the same old questions I've seen. Is this like, who's going to write this content? Just like is the main thing. And the tone. I really want to learn more about message architecture, so I'm going to like look up the Intensive that workshop you'll be doing. So I want to see what the syllabus, the abstract for it is. So I want to see what that is all about. But and then the challenges that other industries are having, I think it's just this responsive design. I mean, I'll talk to Sam, throw that to Sam too. But this responsive design is still. I think we got a better handle on some things. Oh, but yeah. But we still have, you know, the responsive images thing is still a pain in the butt for people. So it's kind of a just in terms of content. I mean, and the solution is this is the awesome solution is that we just generate a whole bunch of copies of the same image for different sizes, and we just put that on the server, and then we call it up, and then so we set it, which is like a total I think mankind solution is just a. Just make multiple copies and then pull them from out. But anyway, I think we can get a more refined solution hopefully down the road in the future. But also workflows, because we have to deal with so much content, so much, you see this with Grunt and Gulp, and so we're trying to get plugins to take care of all this content and put in the templates and doing stuff. So there's a lot more that we're asking of our web designers and developers or front end people to do more so than ever before. And everyone's not freaking out, which is crazy. I thought people would be freaking out by now. But it's part of the learning process. You know, that's Dave Rupert talks about leveling up. And this is I feel like that we're doing right now, the past year to 2 years, is we're definitely leveling up a lot more as an approach to dealing with our device. So with that, and that's what Karen McGrain's like. Also, like the analogy with splitting different images, you know, small one mobile-friendly image, a large image for hero graphics, if you will. You know, you have to deal with chunking of content, which is like It's awesome if you have the manpower, but sometimes, you know, we talk about message architecture, you still have to get that right tone. Cause like, you know, you mentioned earlier, like the tone for 144 tweet, is how you do that is going to be different than if you have a paragraph on a blog post to deal with. And so it's right. going to be kind of great. And, you know, and I understand Twitter a lot more than I understand Facebook, you know, and a lot more. I still have no idea about Pinterest, but so it's what it is. So that's what I feel about it. So I'm going to be quiet now. Let's see.
That's so interesting. Cause like, and so much of what you just said though, mm-hmm. it goes back to the wetware. It goes back to the people. Are we asking them to do too much? Mm-hmm. I think that one of the first things you said with the problem with content is, well, who's still going to do all of this?
Yeah.
And yeah, we got to fix the people problem around training and education and making sure we're asking them for the right things.
Right. You know, and then I work, Austin is a tech startup scene that's probably behind New York City and San Francisco. Like it's coming up, you know, with South by Interactive. I'm looking forward to seeing you again at South by. And, I might slot an hour of your time for mentor room, but, whole hours, like, yes, an additional hour. They just write content, and sometimes, you know, the content just doesn't jive with what they're doing. There's one startup, I don't want to name names, but it's just one startup I have in mind. It's like, they have an awesome solution. They're like, it's really disruptive. They're really doing a great job, but their content vibe is just doesn't in sync with what it is. And part of it is this, maybe I have to, you know, maybe it's my, me, I'm not being the right demographic for them, but also I feel like, you know, I could be a consumer of their product, but I just feel like it doesn't really jive with me. And so that's, So I feel like a lot of startups are so busy getting the code out the door and getting out there that to make a viable product, a minimum viable product, that they're not really seeing the little steps. And so, and sometimes that's a luxury, you know, sometimes you just have to get the startup has to get out the door so they can prove a concept, but then they have to, like, part of that is it would go a long mile. They, you know, to add that right tone and right feel to it. So, but yeah. But also is right. Like, right. who's gonna write that, you know?
Yeah. So,
but Sam, sorry. Mm.
Of course, I'm gonna come in with this from the educational angle, but not just, I feel with design, and I'm making this assumption about content, which I know that making that assumption is very dangerous, but I do feel a lot of what the many things that people have to do now, whether it is a web designer or a content strategist, is educating whoever else they're working with, whether it's the developer or the designer or the strategist or the copywriter or the client, and having to bring them into the process so that they understand the value of each of the steps that are being taken. And then on the other side of education, I feel like having a web design, you know, 12-week immersive course and teaching that content was how the course starts in my mind. And the last time I ran it, content came before design, Photoshop, Illustrator, any of that. And this time we still did we moved the code up front just to get the technical side of being able to build something and then talking about content and moving away from lorem ipsum and things like that. But it still comes up that when you're building something as a designer and you're having to be that generalist that does the logo, does the style guide, does the, a save for web for all the images so that you do have a site that loads quickly, and also having to write the content, having to give those, and here's a cat walking by. Of course. She has to get her, awesome. Her like 1 second. Wow. Okay. But just having to give them enough of a foundation, understanding the value of content so that can become a part of their design process. It's a lot to ask for, but it is, again, something that's like impossible to ignore and just say, oh, you'll get content, and teaching just to that ideal. Sure. We'd love for the content to be figured out and for designers to be a part of it. But sometimes they're just handed lorem ipsum or said, oh, we'll give it to you later. And so just dealing with the different scenarios of that sort of thing. Yeah, I know, that freaks me out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because without the content, or at least without understanding the goals of the content, how do you know what you're designing about? If only we could talk to each other first and say, what are we both working toward? Could that ever happen? Those are my flying cars. Collaboration, that's my flying car.
Margo, how can people find you on the internet? I know we talked about it in the beginning, but...
Margo@appropriateinc.com. Those are two best places to reach me. And if I'm not there, it's probably because I'm outside walking my dog.
And Sam?
I am Sam Cap across the board on almost everything except my website, which is samcapila.com.
Okay, awesome. And I am I'm Christopher Schmidt. I am at Teleject on the Twitters. Really, that's... I understand Twitter. That's about it. So I don't blog as much as I should. So I don't know. I don't know what my message architecture is for my blog yet. So figure it out. But you find me there.
We can work on that.
Also, I am on ChristopherSchmidt.com and where else? And definitely follow us more for podcasts at nonbreakingspace.tv. Mm-hmm. And follow us at YouTube where we do these things live at mm-hmm. Non-Breaking Space Show. On YouTube, so you can subscribe there. And also join us on our mailing list because I'll be mailing out reminders about the show and transcripts and stuff like that too. So pretty shortly. That's about
and
it.
And happy belated birthday, Chris.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes. Cool. And I'm really happy because I got a new wall art thanks to Ari. So I got an ampersand on the back on my wall. Nice LED light there. Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks, Margo, for being with our guest today.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.